The Guardian.
Well, hello there, and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Jemima Kish. This week, we find out which products Google is choosing to shut down and why. We'll be looking at DNS hacking after high-profile sites like The Telegraph, Vodafone and Betfair were targeted by a Turkish hacker group. And the brand new Amazon Kindle, which is nothing like any Kindle you'll have seen before. Why is it so good, and should Apple really be worried? Keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Techness from The Guardian. Joining me this week are The Guardian's tech editor, Charles Arthur, developer advocate Michael Brunton-Spall, and later on, former ZDNet staffer David Mayer will be joining us on the line from Berlin. Welcome all.
Hello.
Hi.
So tell me, which of you are Google Plusing? Honestly, who's actually using Google Plus?
Me, not very much at all.
You've dabbled.
I've sort of dipped feet in, and I find it's just too prolix. It's just too much blah 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 blah.
That was rather my consensus on it, is that there's some good ideas in there. It's very typically Google in that it's very heavily engineered, but it's lacking a sort of social focus that really drives people to use this.
I'm not using it as a replacement for Twitter or blogging at the moment, but I have found its photo sharing service particularly useful on my Android phone. I take pictures and it automatically uploads them as I go, and then when I get back home, they're already there and uploaded, and I can just select which ones I want to share, and that URL is then public that can be shared with people who aren't using Google Plus. So I'm finding it quite useful for that.
I think when they properly turn the tap on fully and they start plugging Google Plus into everything from YouTube to Gmail, then it will really start getting quite powerful. But at the moment, it's not quite there for me. Now, you might not heard of Turk Gervenli before, but it's a name being cursed by some of the UK's biggest name websites after it claimed to have been responsible for a successful DNS hack at the weekend. The group already targeted a Korean company in August, but picked out Acer, Vodafone, UPS, The Telegraph, National Geographic and The Register. Turk Gervenli hacked into the domain registrar to change DNS records for those sites, diverting unsuspecting customers to a page proclaiming hacking success for the group. Charles, can you tell us exactly what the group did and how they did it, please?
They hacked into netnames.co.uk, and what they seem to have done is to have hacked into one of the admin control panels. They did this using a technique called SQL injection, which is basically if there's a database driving a page, then you can, if you're very subtle and clever, use the right technique, you can make the database in effect fall over and give you control of the page. They then were able to log in as an admin and go in and change the registration details, or the DNS details, that is, where would you be directed in terms of the IP address when you typed the register.co.uk or telegraph.co.uk into your browser. Because of the way that DNS works, this didn't happen for everyone. Not everyone saw it at the same time. And they just seem to have taken some of the larger sites that they spotted on the NetNames register.
Yeah, because they didn't seem really connected in any way, these sites. They seemed quite randomly selected.
It was really very random. I think they just cast their eye down the list, because it's a very, very, very big list that NetNames looks after, who the registrar's for. So when you type the register.co.uk, your computer asks a DNS server, domain name system server, what is the IP address for this thing. When the DNS record was changed, that meant that your computer was told to go to a different site, which was actually one in the US hosted by a company called Blue Mile Solutions. And so everyone was actually being directed to the same page, whether they're going to Betfair or whether they're going to Vodafone or UPS. They were actually all getting directed to this particular page at this cloud computing company. And that made some people think, oh my God, the Telegraph means hacked. In fact, the sites themselves were running perfectly fine. And if you'd gone to their original IP address, you would have been able to find them. And again, because of the way DNS propagates, it gets passed around from server to server when there's a change. Not everyone saw it, but some people did, and some people got very spooked.
So this company, Blue Nile, they had no connection to the hack at all. Why did they end up being the place where everyone was being diverted to?
Because the hacker simply had set up a page or set up a site with them, and you know, told all the DMs to point to it.
No particular vendetta against them.
No, nothing against them, and nothing, you know, particularly the, you know, I'd sort of had a brief email interview with the hacking group, and there's, you know, they've got no animus against anyone. They just like it. They just said they're doing it for the fun.
Michael, can you tell us about the salacious motivations of hackers? I mean, why are they doing it? Is it really just about kudos or thrill, or is there any kind of more substantial motive in there?
The part that always worries me is that most of these hacking groups are doing it for the thrill. They're doing it so that they can show off to the other hacking groups and prove who's the better set of hackers, who can have more of an impact and who can get more headlines. But if a hacking group were to decide to do it for malicious reasons, in a way of stealing users' identities, stealing users' passwords and getting access to their accounts, this sort of attack would be perfect for doing so. And I think in many cases, an organisation who's more organised and had decided to do that would be able to do so undetected for far longer, which always makes me nervous.
And Charles, there were some security concerns about people who had login details on Betfair and Vodafone, I think. Is that right?
It might have been possible that if you were trying to log into them, that you might have passed some of your details along. The group didn't seem to be collecting that sort of detail in any way. So I think that the concerns were probably overblown, but never a bad thing to be wary about it, because you can't be sure. As Michael says, you know, if they wanted to, they could have done things like changing the mail exchange records so that they could have done it, you know, just watched any mail that was going through. They could have just set up a man in the middle server and just filtered all the mail, collected it, passed it on.
Then, of course, anybody at the Telegraph or the Register who had an account on another site, you could go and say, reset my password, and your new password would be sent to the hackers, and then they would have access to your site. And the implications of being able to change the mail exchanger as well as the website is quite fundamental. The control the hackers then had over the domain is amazing.
Can companies do anything to protect themselves against this type of hack? And how common is a DNS hack compared to other types that we've seen recently?
So DNS attacks aren't terribly common. This one in particular is very unusual, to attack the registrar itself, normally because, as the hacking group themselves admitted, to attack a registrar is incredibly difficult because they're very protective. Of course, Netnames have hundreds of thousands of companies' details registered with them, and they're very protective of that. That is their core business.
Oops.
Yes, losing such a thing. Interestingly, the last one that I can find a record of somebody doing something approaching similar was actually the same registrar 10 years ago. A hacking group, and in fact a hacker who went by the title of Fluffy Bunny, did the same thing. He was able to take over control of a massive number of domains just by hacking into a DNS registrar. But overall, in last year, Zone H, the website that hackers often put their hacks up on to show off to the world and show how good they are, registered only 7,000 DNS attacks via the normal DNS methods of cache poisoning and so forth. So compared to the 1.5 million other forms of attack, which normally come in via the traditional systems such as SQL injection, comes in via breaking a bug that's in the web code, or even socially engineering the administrator, phoning up the administrator and explaining you're from the IT department and that their password needs to be changed. Could you tell me your old password? Which works in hundreds of thousands of cases every year. It amazes me.
Do we know how long this kind of attack would have taken for them to work on?
They had done one against Korea earlier in the year, and they said that they'd been looking at this one for some time. Now, that's probably
months. Fairly woolly.
It is, because it's the sort of thing where, you know, you've doing SQLI is not trivial. You have to find the flaw. You've really got to keep working away at it. It's quite slow and quite tedious work if even if you are experienced. And, you know, as Michael says, these are sites which will have a lot of protection. So I think they would have been plugging away at this for some time.
The chances are the hacking group would have been attempting to attack some large sites first. So they may have gone for the Telegraph or the Register first, tried everything there. When they couldn't find anything there, they may tried DNS exploits against the DNS servers. When they couldn't find anything there, they finally graduated up to attacking the registrar itself. I actually suspect it's far more likely that they'd been attempting to attack the registrar for some time and had finally got something, and it was just an opportunity attack. They finally got in and were like, right, quick, which sites can we change before anybody notices that we've managed to break in?
This is just the latest in a string of hacking stories over the last sort of 12 to 18 months. Is it just that there is more activity, or are we just hearing about it more? And actually, is the media coverage just making things worse? I mean, I know these guys are probably hoping to get jobs as well as building up a bit of kind of hacker street cred, but is reporting on these things just making it worse?
There is significantly higher hack activity in the last year. Zone H's info shows 1.5 million attacks last year. If you go back to 2003, it was only 250,000 attacks. And in fact, looking at the change up to about 2009, there was only a couple of 100,000 attacks still. And then last year, there was just an absolutely enormous increase in the number of attacks that were happening. Part of that, I suspect, might be the Anonymous effect, that Anonymous have been pushing more and more of these defacement attacks, because Zone H is only really interested in defacement attacks where somebody takes a website and is able to put their own message up in front of it. They're not interested in people who hack into databases and steal credit cards and things like that. So it's only a specific form of them, but there are more now.
The gravity of them has also increased. I mean, you have things like Stuxnet, which is the most sophisticated piece of computer hacking that I think the world has ever seen, really. You know, the complications involved in writing that and the target that it had, which is, you know, the Iranian nuclear program, is enormously complex. And more recently, we've seen the hack against Komodo, which was to steal SSL certificates. We've seen a hack against a Dutch company called DigiNotar, again, to steal SSL certificates. The level of what's going on is much greater as well.
Well, assuming we do decide to continue covering these, you can read plenty more at guardian.co.uk/technology. Have you ever played with Aardvark, FastFlip or SideWiki? Chances are you haven't, so you won't miss those and seven other products Google has decided to close down. The decision was down to Google's newest chief executive, Larry Page, who in January claimed the rollback from Eric Schmidt after 10 years and has been throwing his weight around as part of an efficiency drive. Most engineers from these projects are going to be rerouted to Google+. So, Charles, I have a list here of the products that they're going to close. So I suppose you get a point for every one of these you've heard of. So there's Aardvark, Desktop, FastFlip, Google Maps API for Flash, Google Pack, Google Web Security, Image Labeler, Notebook, SideWiki, and Subscribe Links. Can anyone help?
So I've used Aardvark, which is like a question and answer service, somewhat like a Quora or Stack Overflow, where people can put questions up and you register the things that you might be able to answer. But I haven't seen much activity on it recently. So
I think the question now will be, why are they shutting us down?
I mean, we scrutinise this more because it's Google and we expect them to be massively successful. And perhaps we're also a little bit English in our approach to failure. It's a good thing, isn't it, if they're closing down inefficient products and folding them into something more successful?
If they are inefficient and they're not attracting the kind of attention they need, then yes, I think it's good that Google is shutting them down. It's freeing up their engineers to work on some of the more interesting projects. On the other hand, they're also shutting down Google Labs, which I think is probably a mistake because it's one of the key areas of innovation for Google, and it allows people to play with and use the new things. Where is their next Google Mail going to come from? Do they expect only product direction to produce interesting ideas, or will Labs still have a place?
Well, similarly, Yahoo shut down Brickhouse quite a while ago now, but isn't the thinking there that it's better to have innovation involved more deeply in every part of the business rather than kind of hiving them off into a separate chunk?
I just think generally, you know, you go back, you look at this list of things. I mean, they also shut down Photovine quite recently, which was a new acquisition that they just decided, oh, no, it's not going to do it. But things like SideWiki, things like FastFlip, the trouble with releasing lots of products, even if you're then going to shut them down, if you say, well, it's not very good, is that, in effect, it's a distraction. It's an opportunity cost. And Larry Page has said, you know, that's one of the things that he said in a big staff meeting. He said, what's our greatest cost? And people said, ooh, electricity? I don't know, is it the lobster that we provide? And he said, no, it's opportunity cost. It's the time you spend doing one thing when actually you could be doing something better. And if you're producing a fast flip where everyone looked at it and said, this thing where you're sort of showing us newspapers and we sort of flick on through them on a PC and we have to click the thing and it's not actually like a newspaper at all, this is stupid, isn't it? And they said, no, it's really great. But actually, it's not really great. And, you know, experience has completely borne this out. And if there had been a more rigorous process of saying, why the hell are we doing this exactly? You know, rather than, oh, I don't know, let's throw it out there and see if it, turns into a monster. Then they would have a lot less wasted effort. And I think that's possibly a good thing that he's doing this now, that he's saying, okay, let's really focus. Let's not waste this opportunity cost. Let's actually, spend it in an effective way.
Well, that's an interesting point, because Google obviously is not short of a bob or two. So that they, in terms of money, they can definitely put money into resources. But is it more about people and talent and where their energy is focused?
It's absolutely not about money. It's absolutely about people. Google is very much about have a reasonably sized team of people. I mean, if you think about Apple and Microsoft and Google as sort of companies which write software, Microsoft is like, I know, we'll get an army in here and they'll write it. Google is, okay, we'll get sort of 10 people in here and they'll write it. And Apple is, yeah, we'll put two people in a room, they'll write it. So, Google has the staff, but they don't sort of overspend. And the idea is to use the right number of people doing the right number of things. And I think that this sounds like a rationalisation there.
Michael, can you see, as a hardcore Aardvark user, any tangible ways in which Aardvark will be rolled into Google Plus? Are there any kind of usability factors? Because Aardvark was quite nice and touchy-feely, and Google Plus arguably isn't.
Aardvark, for its time, had some very interesting approaches to communicating with the user. So Aardvark was one of the first products I used that encouraged me to add my SMS details, my instant message details, my email details, and my Twitter details all as one. And it would connect with me over any of those mediums and then allow me to respond. Whereas when you look at equivalent products, so essentially Aardvark was just a Quora for answering questions. Quora and Google Plus and things like that allow you to post a question and have people answer, all center around the website and you choosing to visit the website. The fact that Aardvark would reach out to the user where they were and get them to answer it, I think proved to be a bit of a distraction. Whenever it would message me, I would be in the middle of dinner in a restaurant with my wife and kids or something like that, rather than actually in a place where I could answer a question about how to install Django on a Solaris server.
Sounds like being stalked by a very, very nerdy three-year-old.
It's something like that.
Larry Page apparently asked the product managers of all sorts of products to pitch a 60-word explanation of their projects to him to personally vet, presumably, which of those were going to be axed. Is that a fair way of deciding what stays and what goes?
Absolutely. The elevator pitch is critical to startups, and if more large organisations took the idea that people should know exactly what they do and be able to define it easily and simply, that we would have much better products coming from those organisations.
60 words is pretty challenging, you've got to say. I mean, do you leave out, it's like sort of just a minute, but in reverse?
Well, when I first saw that, I thought it was, I sort of misread it as 60 characters, and I was like, no, that's half a tweet! So that really would be impossible. But then again, if you've got to pitch it to a member of the public, and they've got to understand what it is, maybe that wouldn't be a bad thing. But there's more on this story from Josh Halliday, which you can find at guardian.co.uk/technology. Next, speculation about Amazon's new tablet has reached fever pitch after one lucky TechCrunch journalist managed to get his hands on one. The new Amazon Kindle is a step change from the last, a full-colour touchscreen, Android-powered, and with an interface that apes CoverFlow. Now, Charles, we've heard the end of November is the planned launch date for this. Is that just US? When can we expect to get this in the UK, and have we got any indication of price so far?
Starting from the back, I would say that the expectation is the price will be around $250, so undercutting the iPad. Expected to be a 7-inch screen. MG Siegler from TechCrunch travelled up to Seattle to see Amazon, and I think this is a careful piece of PR on the part of Amazon. He was trying out a prototype, not quite a production version yet. The expectation is, and analysts are saying this as well, people in Forrester and so on, so the drumbeat has begun, and I think Amazon is carefully seeding this around people. The expectation is, I think it'll just be in the US to begin with, that they'll basically go for the big market, where it's relatively easy to get a single market going, and UK will probably follow in 2012. The interesting thing, I think, will be the question of, actually, will it be Android, or will it be building on the basic Android code but stripping out all the
Google forked
stuff?
It, they've
forked it, yeah. They've stuck a fork in it.
Tell us what that means.
Well, it's, when you come to a fork in the road, you should take it. And so what they've done is they've taken the Android open source code and they've tweaked it in their own way to make it their own operating system, which will behave in slightly different ways from the Google-approved version.
Is this really going to give the iPad a run for its money, though? I mean, what in terms of features are really going to compete or give it the edge, even?
Well, we don't know anything about exactly what features it will have, but what I think makes Amazon stand out from all the other companies that are trying to do tablets, and even Sony in this, is that Amazon is really good at selling content to people, and Amazon has a huge stack of people who are already its customers. Rather as Apple does, Apple has all the people who've bought stuff from the iTunes store down the years since 2003, and they have 100 million or so, or 200 million, you know, it's in the hundreds of millions, credit card details with them. Amazon is, you know, bucking around there. It's got that sort of same sort of number. So when you go into an Amazon tablet, I think you'll be presented with all sorts of ways. You know, do you want to buy this? That's fine. Here you are. Log in. You know, log in with your Amazon account. Why would you not? You know, if you're Jeff Bezos thinking, how can we make people, you know, really get tied to this tablet? You would get them to sign in with their Amazon account. I think it's entirely sensible. And that's a way that then you have a shop front. You can buy digital stuff. They own one of the digital film companies. They own Love Film in the UK. The sky's the limit, I think.
It's a really good point. And actually, it's probably not Apple that will be anywhere near as worried as Google.
Well, I think it's a problem for Google because the thing about all the Android tablets, and I have tried a lot of Android tablets.
I know, you found one on your desk earlier.
I found one that you'd forgotten
about. It was under a pile of paperwork.
Yeah, because they all look the same. They're all 16:9 layout. You start them up and they have honeycomb on them and you go, now what? Whereas the iPad sort of goes, hey, use me, look, I've got all these apps. And the app store on the iPad is simply streets ahead of what it is for honeycomb. You know, you search through the honeycomb market, and actually, you know, if you have any sort of niche interest, then it just isn't served by the Android market.
So, Michael, it sounds like things are finally all about paid content and a simple way of paying for content. Is this really good news for app developers?
I think it is good news for app developers. Theoretically, we haven't seen the details yet, but theoretically, people who make paid apps for the Android marketplace will be able to put them up on the Amazon marketplace as well. And of course, Amazon have already put their Amazon marketplace in place, allowed developers to get access to it, to start putting information on there, putting their apps up, finding out how things sell in it. And all the information I'm hearing is that Amazon's marketplace is working very well if you choose to be on it. How many people are choosing to be on it? I suspect it's quite small numbers. Until the tablet comes out, I think the tablet will make a massive difference to that. Paid apps for developers, of course, the iTunes and the iOS app rush is more or less over. You can't get in there and make the next Angry Birds anymore. All of the indications for game developers is that they all missed the boat and they needed to be there 5 years ago, not now. So don't quit your job and start building iPhone apps now, but maybe Amazon Pad apps.
And how about developing for Microsoft? Is that a kind of no-go, or is there any potential there? So some excitement.
Every time I meet a developer who develops for the Microsoft mobile devices, they are always extremely passionate and extremely excited to be developing for the Microsoft devices. However, whenever I meet somebody who hasn't developed for them, they've never heard of any of the abilities in there. So I think it's quite a divisive developer community. You very rarely meet somebody who's done both.
Really good news for app developers. I mean, what really is the big incentive in developing for Amazon over Apple, say?
That's hard to know, actually. I mean, Michael's point about, you know, you can't be the next Angry Birds. Well, actually, something's probably going to be the next Angry Birds.
Something has to be the next Angry Birds.
Exactly. I just think that Amazon has a better chance to really interest people because it's a name people know, because it's a shop front that people know. So there's potential there. I think the question of whether the 7-inch format will work better than the 10-inch format is an interesting one. If this the hands-on that MG Siegel had is right and that's how it comes out, which I would expect, then it sounds like what Amazon are doing is not going where the opponent is strong. You don't try to pitch into the 10-inch market when Apple is completely murdering it. You go into the place where Apple is not, where RIM is making no noticeable impact at all with a 7-inch tablet. So, again, that's an interesting strategic move, and it'll be interesting to see whether they can create a whole new space for themselves.
Charles will be scrutinising this and other tablet-related news at guardian.co.uk/technology. The world's largest trade consumer electronics show finally wraps up in Berlin on Wednesday, and it has been all about the hardware. After 5 days of pounding the trade show floor, David Mayer has the lowdown on the new HTC handsets running Windows Phone Mango, plus how the patent war between Apple and Samsung scuppered some of the plans to promote the new Samsung Galaxy Tab at the trade show. David joins us on the line from Berlin, where he's nursing his IFA-induced blisters. Hello, David.
Hello.
So Android tablets, they were really the big news at the IFA, weren't they? Tell us what you discovered.
Well, there were several new models. We saw Toshiba release a new tablet. We saw Lenovo get into the consumer tablet game as well, a little bit of a belated entry there. They still sort of all look the same, it must be said, if I'm going to be completely honest, but they certainly have become more impressive with the software they're running. People are trying out various ideas. There was even something of a credible-looking Windows 7 tablet from Samsung as well, which surprised me.
And Ultrabooks as well. This was something else you were impressed by.
Yes, that's right. So Intel's come up with this whole idea of an Ultrabook, which is basically just a very thin laptop, clearly kicked off by the MacBook Air, that particular market. It's a bit of a marketing term, but we are sort of seeing very, very impressive-looking devices come through here. I mean, these aren't hardcore gaming machines, but seeing them in the flesh, they are certainly very attractive. They're thin, they're solid-looking, and they've got surprisingly punchy processor power as well.
Do they have the sort of the battery life that that's meant to be the thing about the MacBook Air, and how do they compete on price there?
In terms of battery life, I can't really say. I haven't had a chance to sort of put one through its paces. In terms of the price point, well, that's a very good point, because they're generally around the $1,000 mark, which should translate into 600 and something pounds. But in reality, you and I know that it'll translate into about £1,000. And that's not particularly attractive, particularly when at that price point you can kind of go, well, it's either this or it's that sexy MacBook Air that's really going to impress everybody. So analysts are saying that these manufacturers need to come in at much lower price points. And while they are attractive devices, I certainly can see what they're saying there.
Digitimes was saying that the number of Ultrabooks being shipped is pretty small. They're talking about 50,000 units from each manufacturer in this quarter, which sounds like a very low number. It sounds like they're having trouble getting the price down. Why would that be? Why would they have trouble with the price and do you think with the volume?
Well, I would say it's probably sensible, actually, to start off with relatively low runs of these things. You've still got a netbook market where the price point is much lower, so it's not a sure thing that people will be snapping up these so-called ultrabooks. The reason for the price problems, I would say, is largely down to components such as the solid-state drives that they need, because you can't stick a normal hard drive into these things. It's just too thick. So you have to use an SSD, and at the moment, it's a bit of that chicken and egg situation where production for solid-state drives haven't ramped up to the degree that's needed to really bring the price down. So they're still pretty pricey, certainly for the amount of storage you're getting per pound.
We saw some quite interesting posturing from the Lenovo boss, who was claiming that Samsung's Galaxy Tab had actually only sold about 20,000. What do we think of those figures? What's the story there?
Well, it's very anecdotal, and it does sort of have a little bit of a whiff of trash-talking by the opposition. But at the same time, Samsung has never been clear about how many it's actually sold of its Galaxy Tab, and we must be clear here that we're talking about the original Galaxy Tab that came out a year ago at IFA. And Samsung's other Galaxy Tabs are sort of separate from this particular thing. But at the beginning of this year, Samsung said that it had shipped about a million, I've seen some reports saying 2 million, of these devices. One of Lenovo's top executives for the European region told me at IFA that Samsung really only sold 20,000 of them. Now, I've spoken to analysts about this, and there seems to be a little bit of doubt over whether it was really that low. It was pointed out to me, quite rightly, I think, that you would have heard people in the retailers themselves actually grumbling about this and sending back vast quantities of the things, sending them back to Samsung, much as Best Buy did with the HP touchpad, just before HP decided it wasn't worth the bother. So we didn't really sort of see that kind of dissatisfaction. But at the same time, we've got no indication of how many they actually did so. And when I took that 20,000 figure back to Samsung and went, well, is this right or wrong? They said, oh, sorry, we're still not going to say.
Yeah, funny that.
Worry.
But there was some other bad news for Samsung as well, because there's the ongoing patent battle between Apple and Samsung, which meant that they had to withdraw the new Galaxy Tab from display. Is that right? I mean, did you manage to see one? What's going on there?
I did manage to see one, you know, when I was hanging around IFA. But then, apparently, a court order suddenly appeared at the Samsung stand and told them to take it off display. Now, the Galaxy Tab 10.1, which was revealed earlier this year, so it's not a new product, was originally, I assume, supposed to be on display along with all of Samsung's other tablets and Android devices. But that is the subject of a temporary injunction, which was granted by a German court last month. That temporary injunction forbids Samsung from selling or indeed marketing the Samsung Galaxy Tab 10.1 in Germany. Now, obviously, putting it on the stand at IFA would constitute marketing, so they weren't able to do that. That wasn't much of a surprise. But the fact that they announced a product and then within a couple of days they had to suddenly whisk it off the stand, I think that came as a big surprise to them.
I'm not sure that a few heavies turning up with a court order is quite the kind of marketing stunt that Samsung had in mind for that. Also, we heard some interesting stories about the Ford technology, which has got quite a bit of coverage. But tell us about the child settings.
Yes, I found this very amusing. It's brilliant. Ford is introducing a way for parents to really annoy their children without even having to be in the car with them. It's a technology called MyKey, and Ford originally brought it in a couple of years ago in the US as a way for businesses to control their fleet cars. And it does things like you can sort of preset the top speed limit on the car, which obviously makes a lot of sense for that. Now, Ford says they have a much higher accident rate for under 25s. So they've come up with this way of using the MyKey technology to control the young, really, I suppose. The parent gets a master key, which they can use to drive normally, as it were, and also to program the car. So they can set the top speed limit. They can set the top audio volume on the car stereo, and I thought that was a particularly annoying thing to do.
I can foresee some interesting hacking challenges for some of the more kind of entrepreneurial children out there. David, thank you very much for joining us. And there's plenty more on all these stories at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Well, that's all for this week's podcast. You can see all the links from this programme at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Ta to Charles, and top regards of the day to Mr. Michael Brunton Spall and Mr. David Mayer. The producer was Ian Chambers, and I'm Jemima Kish. We'll be coming through your pipes again next Tuesday, so see you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.